Welcome back to another episode of Slate House Presents. I'm your host, Trevor. Today, I am joined by author Meredith Katz. Meredith Katz, whose pronouns are she, they, is a writer and editor who lives in Canada with her lovely wife and their beautiful nonsense cats. She is the author of several queer novels and novellas and also works in tabletop and video games. They love tea, monsters, and sweet things that go bump in the night. Welcome, Meredith, to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm so grateful to you for coming on and talking, especially because, as you know, Caitlin and I are both really big fans of the novella that you wrote back in 2016, The Cybernetic Tea Shop.
It means so much to me that you reached out to have me. Seriously, I'm really moved that this little story has touched so many hearts, honestly.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful, beautiful book. And Caitlin and I actually on the show, we recorded kind of our review, our thoughts. We did a whole deep dive, kind of dissecting a lot of the story. But it's definitely one that stood out to both of us in 2023. And I was struck by just how resonant the book still feels, oddly enough, some, 7 years after its initial publication.
Oof, yeah. it's been a while, but yeah.
Yeah, so I wanted to bring you on the show today to talk a little bit about the book, but also about some of your just kind of thoughts as an artist, because you've been writing now for quite a bit of time in various capacities, either publishing through independent publishers or self-publishing or working in other technical writing and games writing, which is all a very interesting kind of writing career. So as we kind of open the door a little bit, I'd love to pose to you just the question of what moves you as an artist? What are the sorts of stories that you like to tell?
Well, speculative fiction in all of its forms is obviously really near and dear to my heart, and queer fiction in all of its forms. And of course, I just mush those things together and often mush different types of speculative fiction together. I love a good horror romance, you know? I grew up with fantasy, and of course I grew up queer. So these are the things that just have traveled with me through my life. And I guess that's also why I'm in tabletops and video games. It's about the fantasy. It's about playing in that space in a lot of cases. And I guess it's just different parts of my life. I'm cycling around over and over again. Who doesn't? But it's just finding places where things mean other things, where you can tell a story about, like Cybernetic Tea Shop you mentioned, is a story very much about Pike Place in Seattle, a place that I visited a lot as I used to live in Vancouver, as much as it's also about robotics and personhood and identity and fantasy and retro future, which is, of course, just what does the future look like if it's also the past and things like that. So it's hard to say, you know, what really inspires me as a writer, what really gets me going, what things like that, because I start to pull on a thread like that and it pulls up three other genres.
I guess, you know, kind of circling into the question of spec fiction, because I obviously love speculative fiction. And kind of all that it is able to encompass. But I also think that spec fiction means very different things to different readers. Right. And I think it also means different things to different writers. So what is spec fiction to you? Maybe not necessarily just in a definition sense, but what is it about the genre that pulls you in as both reader and writer?
So really good question. I think when you're writing about strictly the real world as it exists, which many people do very successfully and beautifully, you don't have the same room for metaphors. I'm always reluctant to say like something is a direct one-to-one correlation, but I think that fantasy can stand for a great metaphor. Like I said, retrofuture is just what is the future like if it also reflects the past? And things like that. It's you're bringing in elements of otherworldliness or fully otherworldliness to, again, I don't want to say represent because that sounds too one-to-one, but to stand as a mirror to real life. And I like working at things from angles and shadows and mirrors and smoke and things like that, in a way that I don't as much enjoy just tackling the real world. I think there's many wonderful stories to be told in the real world directly and with the spotlight fully on any sort of area of it, thrillers or drama or anything like that. But instead of wanting to write a billionaire romance, for example, the standard genre of, you know, so and so happens to fall in love with a billionaire and they have to work out their class and social differences, my equivalent story is the billionaire was a dragon who hoards video games. Yeah. So if I come at it from that angle, it's just like, okay, what does a hoard mean? What does the desire to have this massive sense of ownership that a dragon's hoard is over things, but it's also a dragon who's not going to think about things exactly like a human. And you can't do this one-to-one comparison of like the 1% as they are to a dragon because it's an inhuman mind with who approaches things differently. So I don't have to bring in necessarily the real world baggage that's associated with that fantasy in the same way.
It's also interesting though, because I think that the metaphor, right, in playing with a metaphor acts transformatively to broaden up kind of some of the way that we converse about these issues. You mentioned the idea of like a billionaire dragon, and the way that a dragon might, you know, think differently than a human about a horde. But I think in a way that also opens up a real conversation about the transformative power of wealth, for example. I'm in total agreement with you. I love spec fiction for the same kind of reason, you know, the way that it opens up a dialogue about really difficult concepts and allows us to kind of have like to build a community around this conversation and interrogate, you know, who we are in this real world space. So your book, The Cybernetic Tea Shop, which is of course, you know, the book that I asked you in to talk about, what are some of the metaphors that you wanted to kind of represent, or what were some of the conversations that you wanted to spark through that particular piece of fiction?
It's so hard to talk about this without getting into an entire essay in some regards. So please bear with me on this. Like I was saying, I think it's important to just like say upfront that like in-world, real-world bigotry about situations that don't exist in real life cannot stand as a one-to-one comparison. Like I write a dark erotic series also called Pandemonium, where the demons literally do predate on humans, like they're predators, like succubi or incubi draining their energy and things like that. And the humans might fear demons to the point of ignoring their personhood. And ignoring the personhood is still bad, but it's, you know, it's the issue of like the X-Men is like you can't do a one-to-one relationship because it's not the same as humans to humans. The if the Brotherhood of Mutants attacks and blows up a bunch of humans and they have superpowers that can boil them from the inside, that's not the same thing as real world racism at all. And you can't hold that as a one-to-one comparison, but you can, like we were talking about, draw a different sort of comparison or mirror on some of the emotions involved and the fears involved and the sense of empathy that may need to be developed in the characters or things like that, and make you look at a situation through a different lens without saying this fantasy racism is exactly the same as real life racism or things like that. So, like, I don't want to necessarily say that in the cybernetic tea shop, like, this stands exactly for that, but it is the story of a robot in an asexual but homoromantic relationship with an asexual woman. And that's tackling a real world prejudice that exists around asexuals, where asexual people are often likened to robots. And the prejudice around it, this horrible belief, is that asexual people don't feel enough, and that makes them less human. That, you know, that they're missing out on an inherent human experience, which quote. And I hate that. And so I wanted in this story to put in a fully sapient robot with so many feelings. Like Sal has is overflowing with emotion and nostalgia and memory and attachment and all of those things that these people with this prejudice beliefs that they don't interrogate believe isn't possible. and also have her meet a human asexual who is also the same way, overflowing with these emotions and feelings and wanting to help and wanting like personal connections with other people. And then I wanted them to fall in love. And it is a way of speaking to and addressing that prejudice where it's like, why are you saying asexuals are like robots? Why are you saying that? Like, what about this is like that? Like, these are human people. And even if you put a robot in, if you are talking about a fully autonomous robot, like, why wouldn't they have feelings? Like, what, why have you decided that the dividing line is reason versus emotion? But at the same time, like, if people see this book getting pitched and think, oh, it's an ace ro romance with a robot, and then they turn away without reading that, I do not blame them. Like, that's totally fine. We've all in various communities been burnt before, and sometimes you don't want to come too close to that flame. But it also has like Cybernetica Shop also has fantasy racism in it. And like I was saying, it's like it's not a one-to-one comparison. It's more about the human fear of mimicry and dolls in a lot of ways, of the thing that stands in and could pass as human but isn't. But that's also how people act when they other people, when they make turn people into the other or a prejudice or refuse to think of them as the same as themselves. It's that fear of something that's similar to yourself but not the same, that can be have a mirror reflected on it through the form of robots. So it's very much about, you know, what it's like to exist as somebody who is being othered in a community and people using that otherness to shield as like a shield that dehumanizes anything outside of it. So I don't know if that answers your question exactly, but those are, I think, the two main things that I went into present and then dissect in terms of that kind of metaphor.
It's really interesting because I think that it when I was reading the book, of course, I picked up a lot of the same ideas that you're, very much putting down, but I also read into it, from my perspective, of like what do I expect that this is kind of discussing. And I think that was one of the things that was so compelling about it is kind of the flexibility of the metaphor that you've crafted so that it can tackle different forms of this alienation, different forms of this objectification. And in response, it made me think a lot too about the portrayal of certain kinds of romance or the, the way that we even think about relationships or partnerships in the real world. Because the premise for those who haven't read the Cybernetic Tea Shop is that there's, as you said, there's a human mechanic who meets a fully autonomous robot who owns a tea shop, and they have an unlikely romance that kind of leads to a further entwining of their lives. And one of the things they must confront together is this anti-robot racism, which, again, opens the door to discussion. Is it, there's a lot of fantasy racism there. So it's not a one-to-one, just white and black or brown people racism. It could also be about other forms of bigotry too, about the queer community, about, like you say, asexual romances. I certainly read it through kind of a trans coding. That to me was the thing that stood out, I think, the most, just about, again, the complexity of robots and personhood and, kind of the malleability of just a robot form, the
A person who has been designed to present female, like
yes.
physically designed in a factory to present female.
Right. Yeah. And some of the identity building too, which compounds into the romance itself. Because Sal, the robot, has had a previous owner and there was a romantic kind of relationship there, some weird power dynamics to kind of unfold there. But that also leaves kind of this lasting emotional scar on Sal as she tries to grapple with what romance is for her. And can she shake off her prior programming, to connect with someone new? I felt that was a deeply vulnerable kind of writing that just opens so many galaxies to explore, you know?
Well, thank you.
Do you ever feel like writing through metaphor presents significant limitations in what your fiction can address? Or do you feel like part of the process of writing is eventually kind of giving up ownership of your meaning for new interpretation?
I mean, that's not an either or to me. In that I don't feel it limits a, because I can put characters who say I'm asexual in the text. I can have characters who straight up will say one of these things. That's not a problem to me. Like, I can both have in my demon stories, I can have a gender fluid shapeshifter, but also have real like human trans characters. Like, both can exist in the same space in a fantasy world for me. But it's not an either or, because every writing you have to give up on controlling the narrative as soon as it's out of the gate. That's just ultimately death of the author is not like, oh, I, the author, am dead. It's that once you have released it, it is no longer a work that is being written by you. It is now work that's being interpreted by the people who are reading it. And everybody is going to bring their own lenses to it. Like I said, if some people are going to be like, I'm not touching that no matter what anyone said, because I have such personal baggage with the robot issue, cool. Yeah, please don't. You know, that's fine. I get you. Or situations like that. It's people will read things in because everybody bears their own experience with them. And that is just part of the nature of writing. And some of that stuff, I'm just like, yeah, absolutely. That's what I meant to be in there. And sometimes I'm just, you know, so we're all human and make mistakes and read our reviews sometimes. And sometimes you're just like, no, that's not what, how did you get what? And, but that's not on, that's, if you can get it from the writing, it's something that you are taking with you.
This leads me to thinking a lot about, you know, kind of the communities that we build through the stories that we tell. You, as a tabletop player and writer, right?
Yes.
Surely know a lot about, you know, kind of the communal place of storytelling. And I wanted to open up some conversation with you about your community and some of the community that you've built, both as a tabletop writer and a tabletop player, and, you know, an author with, I think, a pretty active community space.
Oh, I try to build a community space. Community is very much about, this is going to sound so much like I'm from software, which I am, but it's about iterative development in a lot of ways, in that improv, like when you're actually doing something live, like at a tabletop or similar to live, I do every year, I do, except for last year, because last year was crazy busy for me, but every year I or my partner does what we call an interactive fiction, which is not what interactive fiction actually is. There's just not a real word for it exactly, where we'll present a premise and a character, and then we can say, hey, you can tell the character what to do next. You can't decide anything else in this world. You don't know what the villains are up to, but say, like, okay, you should open that box, or no, you should return it unsent, or you should do whatever. And then I write that next part from that. And some of the most interesting plot twists have come out of those situations where the community is deciding what to do and they're working together and things like that. And that's the same with tabletop gaming, is ultimately improv is a space of yes and. It's not like if you've said no, or you can say no but sometimes, but you can't do it too often, but you can't just say no. You cannot stop. You have to keep the ball rolling when you're improving, which is the same for D&D or any other tabletop game, is taking an idea someone else presents and then putting your own spin on it. Building a community, I think, is about welcoming in other ideas. Ultimately, if that sort of answers your question, is like tabletop gaming, these pieces of fiction that we do every Halloween and things like that, it's different from traditional writing because it's about welcoming in what other people want to do and then rolling with it. Whereas with something like The Tea Shop or any other story that's traditionally published, is I write it. It went, those were traditionally published through a small press, and they would get accepted, they would go through editing passes. About a year later, it would be published, and I would have no more say over it at that point. It would just have that back and forth of editing. a long pause between when I first conceived an idea and when it was out, and then it's out in the world and it exists for other people to interpret, but there's no more spinning ideas around in that kind of traditional publishing. And I like having both. I want to have a community that I play around with and get involved in my space and yes, and, but also sometimes you have to have a fully formed concept that you see through with your own feelings and thoughts only.
Yeah, I think the communal storytelling is just a, such a fascinating concept, and I want to dig in a little bit with you in a moment. But I love to just kind of this reflection on, you know, kind of the place of a communal voice in not just in helping generate fiction, but also in kind of being the landing field for your fiction. And you referenced a really important notion there, which is kind of like opening doors, which I think is the impact of representation. And your books have great representation because you kind of choose to look at what I think are underrepresented communities in queer fiction. Cybernetic Tea Shop, for example, represents some asexual romance, which is so often overlooked as part of the queer community, but also just overlooked from kind of like a human romantic space. You know, it's so hard to even know what aromanticism or not aromanticism is. That's separate
In this
from
case,
asexuality, right? But to, you know, to know what these terms mean and then to be able to kind of conceive of what that inner life might be like, or what a romance of that nature might actually look like. What have been some of the other representations that you've made in your fiction? And why is it so important to you that we have these stories representing these communities?
Well, I write FF, female. I write sapphic stories. I write gay stories. I've written bisexual characters. I wrote, as you said, ace characters. I have trans characters, non-binary characters. I very much try to write across the queer spectrum. I also try to, of course, include other demographics and things like that because it's important to me to not just create worlds that are this white cishet space that ignores other people. Like, I don't want to ignore people. I want to build a rich tapestry that's full of people of all their kind. But for me, like, as you nailed it, is I'm writing in the queer space as a queer space, not just as like writing sapphic fiction or writing fiction or whatever. And I'm queer. And it's like, I think we have a tendency to silo identities, but the queer community really is a community with a lot of crossover. It's like somebody can identify as lesbian and then be like, I'm demisexual and homoromantic. Like, I'm on the ace spectrum, but I can still like fall in love. And like, once I'm in love, then like things change for me. And maybe later they'll discover they weren't a woman at all. So it's like the queer community is like, there's a joke that goes around. It's like, so and so is LGBT, like all of them at once. But
Maybe
over the course of a
sometimes.
life, someone might, it's, I've seen people respond to that joke with like, yeah, I've been LGBT over the course of my life so far.
I think it opens up, you know, like this real kind of crisis of like identity building, you know, for it's so easy to fall into a routine of just thinking, well, I never really have to interrogate who I am because, you know, like I am who I am. But it real life is so much more complicated than that. And not everyone's experience is the same. You know, I don't necessarily consider myself to be queer, although I am in a queer relationship. And that definitely makes me think about my own sexuality. I think too, you know, for the longest time I thought of myself as neurotypical. And then I come to find out I'm very much not neurotypical at all, you know? And so learning more about specifically having autism and what that means for my life and how that shapes my experiences, and realizing, it's not like I just woke up one morning and decided to be autistic.
Yeah, right.
Like you don't have opportunities sometimes to really interrogate who you are,
Yeah.
and to be able to find the label and understand why the label is so important
Yeah.
in defining, giving definition, like giving borders, or sometimes removing borders, from how you construct your sense of self.
Yes. No, I completely agree. And I think that's the case with many constructed identities. And like, as if there's such thing as an identity that's not constructed, I
Right,
say, you know.
yes, of course.
But it's, for example, like disability is, if one is not disabled now, we will likely at some point in our life be temporarily or permanently disabled. We will have to deal with some sort of injury or illness, and that's something that people deal with in their lives. It's like, it's, this is not a border. It's class-wise, people, you know, like there's that, the majority of people are living paycheck to paycheck, and that is a huge divider between artificial boundaries of class and things like that. I think that having an identity and having a sense of self is vital to us as human beings. Like, we want to explore, we want to be able to do that. We want to find other people who are similar to us, and there are ways of defining that, but also exploring those boundaries. Like, you don't have to identify as queer to explore your gender and sexuality. And once I find that the people who are like identify as cis straight people who have interrogated that in themselves are, it's it, I've seen also a joke, I think, on Tumblr or something, that it's like unlocking cis plus is, like, you're still cis, but you have a better idea of what that means to you as a person, and you're more comfortable in your own skin and less intimidated by the world around you. And I think it's just, it's really important for us to both acknowledge that, like, hey, a lot of boundaries in our life are going to shift over the course of our lives. That's just part of the nature of living. And what a blessing to go through life and find that you've changed, even if it's in ways that maybe you didn't want, or that things are challenging or difficult. What a blessing to have lived through and experienced things instead of having to stop at one place. Often, like, I don't want to underwrite the fact that many of these situations are also a huge challenge. But being alive and living to do it and exploring it and all of that is, it is, you know, what's the old, the unexamined life isn't worth living. Like, I don't, obviously every life is worth living, but I think examining your life and understanding yourself, and then not being attaching everything of value to that current understanding of yourself, because you know you have more years ahead of you, and things, your context and situations will change, and things will, you will discover things that will let you explore these identities deeper and things like that. Life is an experience, I guess, ultimately.
So, how do you feel fiction fits into, this meaning making as it plays a role in our kind of self-discovery, or plays a role in helping us construct, some of that identity?
It gives us a place to recognize that and find these definitions in other people or other characters that you wouldn't necessarily have found otherwise on your own. When I was a kid, like, there was, I'm 40, just I'm 40. When I was a kid, there was not much queer fiction that was easily accessible to me, a kid going to the bookstore and trying to pick up a book with no, there were no defined sections. If there were queer characters in it, they didn't put it on the back of the books. There was no Goodreads, et cetera. So it was a combination of word of mouth, if you knew to listen for word of mouth, and just incidental discovery. And I didn't know I was queer at the time I picked up Mercedes Lackey's Last Herald Mage and found myself with a, with Harold Faneuil, a gay protagonist who got to be a hero. And like, there's many things that are outdated in that writing now, and that would not, you know, there are many things, there's lots of barrier gays and situations like that, that are now a trope because of all of the years of people doing exactly the same thing.
Right.
But the experience of picking up a text and seeing a queer character get to be a hero and save the world and do all of these things and suffer, but also find love and do all of that was huge to me as a kid. And then, you know, it's not just writing. Like, oh, then I went to high school, very shy, very depressed. I was clinically depressed. Met the anime club who were like, oh, we're watching Sailor Moon in Cantonese right now. It doesn't matter. None of us speak Cantonese, but we just want to experience the show, like the stuff that they're not putting on our TV, because it would get, it basically got through the first season, part of the second season, and then refused to put out new episodes. And we didn't know why. And the answer is there are lesbians in it.
Right. Like classically. Yeah.
Yep. And Sailor Moon took over my life for much of my teenage years because of that. But again, it was like, you've got these complicated 16-year-old teens just like yourself who are trying to save the world and doing all of this stuff. And they've been chosen ones by like this galactic force. And, but at the same time, they are, you know, in a relationship.
I'm sorry. The Sailor Moon is just, it's cutting me up because I feel like, haven't we all just been a little bit gay for Sailor Moon anyway?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, Sailor Moon's queer culture. Like, I
oh,
will straight up say
100%.
It's so camp. Like, it's a camp show.
I feel the same way about, I mean, my call to camp is absolutely Adam West Batman. And
oh, yes.
It's so deeply queer coded. And,
oh, yeah.
And I love it for that. Unapologetically, it's my favorite take.
Unapologetically, yeah. No, for sure. Absolutely. But it's the things like that, that like, and sometimes it's things that were not necessarily written intended to be that, but you recognize something of yourself in it anyway. One of the earliest things that I had read to me was Lord of the Rings. And my first ship was Legolas and Gimli.
Oh, I believe it.
Yeah, you know, I was like 7. I didn't really have a concept of what I was doing, but I'm like, okay, they're going to stay together forever. And that's true because it's in the Silmarillion. They're going to stay together forever, or the appendices, rather. It's in the appendices. They're literally, Legolas is going to build a boat to take him to Valinor, even though nobody takes a dwarf to Valinor.
Right.
And like, that was just like, that's the sort of thing where it's like something in there, like you find a connection, even if you don't know you're making that connection.
Right. It's so interesting too. I mean, you bring that sort of thing up. And my brother is like a huge Tolkien head. He just absolutely adores it. But I think too, you know, there is a lack of representation in a lot of media that isn't just strictly sexually coded, you know. I think it's interesting to ship Legolas and Gimli, because of course, like, I think they would make a great gay couple.
Yeah.
I just,
absolutely,
they're so fabulous. But I think too about the way that like men's friendships can only ever be coded, it seems, in media one specific way, so that when we see a friendship that is not coded in the same way as every other masculine friendship, we immediately leap to, well, that must be queer coded. And it's like, maybe not queer coded, but there's so much broader a diversity of representation that we're missing when we only define things in this rigid scope of experience.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And I think that ultimately the solution is, it's the same way as like the issue with like, oh, here's this children's TV show and there's a team and there's three guys and one girl. And that girl is always going to be the one who's kind of bossy and pushy. And she does this and that. And it's like, the answer to having that is more female characters in different roles and you things like that. And it's the same thing, is the more types of friendships and the more types of queer platonic asexual relationships, which are a whole thing, and the more type of things like that, we will get a broader tapestry of like what relationships are in terms of, and I mean relationships in terms of just people interacting with each other, not necessarily romantically. And I think that's an important thing to do in media, is just show all of these different things. Like, you can have like you said, a male friendship that's super, super close and intimate and want to spend the rest of their lives together and not have it necessarily be romantic. if you've also got a gay couple in there
Oh
somewhere,
yeah, absolutely,
because
sure.
then you have now broadened people's minds and shown hey, you've this can exist at the same time as this.
It's fascinating to me the way that intimacy is portrayed in so much popular media. And for me, why it's thus so important to have writers like yourself and stories like the Cybernetic Tea Shop that are able to break out of these little boxes and kind of present to us these metaphors that we can then have these conversations and really start to deconstruct our own notions of what these relationships are, of how even we build and code relationships. I have worked especially hard in the last couple years of my life to build more friendships with men that incorporate real emotional intimacy as a component of that friendship. Because for so long, being vulnerable in front of another man was seen as being a homosexual trait or something like that, in a way that was very damaging to my own sense of self-worth, not because I am afraid of being homosexual, but rather because it projects kind of this fragility that isn't allowed to men, right?
We've created multiple generations of men who are desperate for affection
Oh,
because
yeah.
they're not allowed to receive it. And it's devastating. And it's so much toxic masculinity comes from the fact that people don't just casually say affectionate things to their male friends or hold their hands or hug them or things like that. It's heartbreaking. It really is.
So not to completely change track, because I've loved this conversation, like loved it. But I do want to circle back to this kind of community building and community making that you do through this communal storytelling. You call it kind of interactive fiction, and in a way, it is like you have, polls, or you ask your readers specifically to kind of dictate to you what comes next in the story, in this kind of continually evolving story that you write over. Is it the course of the month of October, or?
It's usually the course of the month of October. Sometimes we'll go a little bit into November if I'm we're so close to having a satisfying piece to an ending, I'm not going to rush it. Sometimes we'll go a little over. But it's usually about 30, 31 days.
So how did that get started? Because I think it is just one of the most fun things I've ever encountered an author doing, for and with their community.
It's kind of a funny story, which is I have seen other, it's called quests on some of the forum boards out there. And it's very different, but it's the same concept, is that somebody would draw a picture, and Ruby Quest is probably the best example you can find. It fully voice acted on YouTube, for example, if you want to check it out. Ruby Quest by Weaver, T.G. Weaver was the name of the author of it on these forums. Some of the readers' feedbacks would get very raunchy, or there'd be bad actors or things like that. But he'd present a picture which was clearly you find yourself on your back, in a dark area. There's a light blinking in front of your face. And then people would respond in the thread, and then he'd respond with a new picture because they'd be like, oh, it's clearly a button, press the button. And then there'd be the little stick figure pressing the button and things like that. And those were quests. And there were some really cool stories that came out of those. Ruby Quest, like I said, great example. Nan Quest by the same author, T.G. Weaver. And I'm sure there are many more that were made that I'm not familiar with and things like that. And I was like, I can do that because I GM many games. I am the game master on in many, not just Dungeons and Dragons, but many systems. And I'm just like, I went in with many of the same rules, which are, hey, the majority will rule here. If everybody says, if there's two contradictory things, the majority will rule. If it's two things that aren't contradictory, I'll try to fold in both. You can only direct the main character, you can't direct anything else. And no bad actors. We can tell if you're a bad actor or if you're padding votes or if you're things like that. So just don't do that. And the first one I did was in 2016. And was very much, it was a Halloween haunted house story, where somebody has, a young man has gone to his rather mysterious boyfriend's family home, and they're just going to have a fun Halloween, watch some movies, and the home is definitely haunted, and the boyfriend is definitely tied to the land and is being slowly devoured by the god beast that lives under the house, and did not want to be alone for what he thought was going to be his final day on the planet. And so that is getting developed through that. So I knew all of that going in. I'm like, okay, I know this is the premise. I know that at every X amount of time, something is going to happen and what that thing is going to be. And then everything else is the players having this jack of all trades, like guy with no personality except for what they develop, because they tell him what to feel. Or then he like that goes in the writing, and then we've established a character, so he'll do the things that are in character for him. And that, so like once they've established that he's going to be like, he's going to try to be calm in an emergency, he's going to think things through, that's how the next narrative section is developed. And then if somebody like puts in a hysterical option, that's less likely to be selected because it's not what the character would do as established. And that builds on, and they go through like very weird situations as this eldritch entity is attempting to reabsorb this guy. And the outcome ended up being something that I didn't anticipate at all, and I don't want to spoil it right here, in case it's all on my website,
Yeah, I was
soft
gonna say
cryptid. If
the archives
yeah,
are still there, right? Yeah.
they're, yep, they're all there. If people want to go read it, you can find it currently under the extras section. But you, there were things that would not have been how I ended it that was a more satisfying ending, because of like. One of the things I find very interesting is I'll often get to a point in these stories where I'm presenting what feels like an impossible choice, because I that's very interesting to throw at characters, is a situation where it's like, oh, well, this character could die or they could become a murderer. I don't want either of these things to happen. And then they're looking for a perfect third option. And as they're spitballing together, I get the idea based off what they're spitballing. I'm just like, this is incredible. You know, and I probably wouldn't write into that black and white thing if I was writing it all on myself. I would write towards a different third idea that I'd come up with in advance, so that the characters would think that they have a black and white choice and then have this other one. But if I just toss that at the players, sometimes they're just, I at least at one point had a bunch of people like, I don't know what to suggest, but find another way. Like, and it's this absolute community refusal. Like, I don't want this. That's sometimes you're just like, okay, it's not going to happen then. And I think that like we get a lot of showrunners who respond to, for example, people's, sorry, I have kitties walking across the screen there. We see a lot of cases of showrunners who are putting out the show, and like a lot of people are just like, we don't want this thing to happen. They're like, I'm going to make it happen. And then they lose their, you know, their fan base because everybody hates it. I think Veronica Mars was a famous example.
I can
Which
come
I
up
haven't
with
seen, I've
like
just heard about it.
I could come up with like a half
Yeah.
dozen CW
Yeah.
shows where that
Yeah, exactly. But if you are writing one-on-one and they're in the writer's room with you, and you see this like, no, this like heartfelt, it's like, okay, we're going to find a different way and we're going to make it so satisfying to all of you, is one of the best feelings in the world as an author who is writing with other people in that space.
How do you feel that this community experience has kind of influenced your own writing, or has kind of shaped your skill as a craftsperson?
Because it's, you have to write and iterate so quickly in that case, because I'm writing, these sections are not short. They vary between 1,000 to 3,000 words. And that's, I'm doing that every day. And then, so I will write them. I basically, what'll happen is I'll take everybody's responses, I'll put it all in a Word document. I will break them down into bullet points, rearrange them to make my outline for that section, write 1,000 to 3,000 words, quickly edit 1,000 to 3,000 words, put it in the like WordPress publisher so it's in a different font and format, then edit it again, and then press go, and it's out in the world and I can't do anything more with it. What it has happened with that has made me a much faster author, much better at iterating. And the other thing that it comes from it is I have to be much more flexible as an author to new ideas. If you are doing one of these and you are not flexible, because like, here's the thing, as an author, you're always thinking of like, oh, I could take it here or here or here or here or here. And instead of doing that, I have to like go, and sometimes I'll make some suggestions at the bottom, especially in the early sections when people aren't familiar with what I'm doing. I'll be like, leave a suggestion in the comments. For example, you could do this, or you could do this, or you could do this, or anything else that you want. But I've got my head pinging all sorts of ways, like, oh, if I do this, it will develop this way. If I do it this way, it'll develop this way. Like down the line, like in 12 moves, I'll have this in check. Like that's how writer brains, I think, many times work, is that you're writing and it's like your head is rushing ahead to try to imagine what the next points are, because you want to write that way. You can't get attached to these outcomes, because you know, so they're going to suggest like you're like, okay, my character's going to go, like he's going to go here or here or here, and they're like, let's go back to the library and look up some information about this sort of thing. And I'm like, okay, who can I put in the library to make this interesting? What sort of messages can come and interrupt so that they get the information, but there's also, I have to put end this on a choice. Like they have to have another choice at the end of this with enough information to make it interesting to them. So it's very, it's it has helped grow my mind to be much more flexible to how a plot is made. And I'm a really heavy like plotter in when I'm doing my own private writing. I will write these outlines, which probably look completely unhinged to anyone else, because I write them like I'm telling a story to my best buddy. So it's like, okay, so anyway, so Sal is a robot, and she's been like around for hundreds of years, and she's winding down, but she owns this tea shop because like her previous owner owned the tea shop and left it in the will. And anyway, so then she's doing this, and so and so comes in, and they act like this. And I basically, there's so much like and so anyway in my outlines. But I do a lot of that, and I try to be flexible about it. So if I get to a point and it doesn't work, that's when I stop and I rewrite the rest of the outline after that point to work with what works better. I try not to get like attached to it. But you can't outline in these. All you can do is the same as tabletop games, is you can know what the other characters' motivations are and what they want to do and what the other characters' timelines are on it. Because as long as you know what is happening in the world around, you can build things out as it develops. But in interactive fiction of this sort, where other people are coming in and giving these quest suggestions, you cannot plot out what the actual story is going to look like. You only have the environment the story is taking place in.
It reminds me a lot of tabletop role playing, and I find the whole experiment to be really, just interesting creatively. Because I don't see a whole lot of different authors kind of doing this sort of engagement and incorporating, a communal storytelling so that at the end of the experience, it's not just yours. It's a story that belongs both in tandem to you and your audience. And that makes a very special kind of art.
Yes, I agree.
I'm sure that there are those who are going to argue about like what kind of quality art comes out the other end at some point. But I think it's very unique. And it gives it a dimension of identity that just seems like it's again, it comes back to that idea of like opening up doors and encouraging, kind of artistic thinking, but also encouraging a kind of thinking outside oneself to perhaps like approach a better empathetic point of view.
I think gaming is like that as a whole. Like you said, like you do tabletop gaming as well. You understand gaming as a whole is very, you're going in there and you're working together in to build a story, but the story isn't, if a DM is controlling the story, it's not fun. You want the DM to be guiding the story. I think that that's just a really interesting space for story building. And I think in actually the tabletop world, we've been seeing that more and more with the rise of the Actual Play podcast, and things like that, Critical Role, the Adventure Zone, and all of that, where they are still playing the game, but people are engaged in watching the game as a story because they're working on making it a story as well as just an adventure and things like that. And it's an interesting space in fiction that I'm watching actively evolve.
Yeah, it's I don't know. I get really excited about it because I think that, you know, this is the kind of crossover between authorial voice and fandom, and the way that that ends up kind of pushing a story to evolve into a new space. It's just really exciting. You know,
I agree. I think it's a very new genre in some ways.
yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we're just about out of time today. So for those of our audience who might want to find more about you and your fiction, where can they go?
Number one place is our website for myself and my partner, who is also an author and editor, Avery Tiernan. We are at www.softcryptid.com. You can also find us together on Twitter X as at Soft Cryptid Book, not books, softcryptidbook. On Twitter, and I am on Twitter as Meredith A. Katz, MeredithAKatz. KATZ.
Well, thank you so much. I really encourage anyone who's listened, if you've enjoyed this conversation, definitely go check out Meredith Katz's fiction. I especially love The Cybernetic Tea Shop. I think it's a great kind of entry into some of the cozier worlds that Meredith crafts. Meredith, thank you so much for coming on the show and for this conversation. This was really, really wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun. I loved every topic we talked about, so thank you.